Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
Our Australian history spot tonight concerns a 15-year-old called Mary Ann Gill, who in 1848 in Sydney attempted to run away from home and marry a gentleman settler, only to have her plan ruined by her gun-toting father. Our historian tonight is Dr. Kira Lindsay. She's from the University of South Australia, who happens to be Mary Ann Gill's great-great-great-niece. She's written a book about her called The Convict's Daughter. Kira, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Phil. It's great to be here.
Yes, well, excellent to have you in. You've always been fascinated by this first generation of native-born Australians, haven't you? The people like your great-great-great-aunt. These are the people who were, well, typically born of convicts, I suppose, but they were born in this country and felt some affinity for it.
Absolutely. So we know that when the convicts came to Australia, they were often they suffered the ridicule and the scorn of being treated as criminals who had no chance of redemption. But the children who were born in the colonies, many people feared that these people would be so tainted by their parents, convict experience, that they would themselves be, would condemn the colony to a life of shame. It would be a society of criminality. But in fact, you know, within a couple of years, people are writing about the native born. They're saying they're taller, they're healthier, they have this direct way of looking you in the eyes. They're a stronger, they're a more moral group of people. And they're also, and this is the thing that really fascinated me, as early as 1810, they're passionate patriots. And they're saying things like they're much prouder to be Australian and they don't even want to go back to England.
Really? Well, what's that all about? I mean, you can imagine, you can imagine convicts earlier on thinking, well, you know, it's a fresh start because there's nothing for me back in England. I'll always be a convicted thief or whatever.
I think
so
it's
Is it about the possibilities that did they see the possibility of you know, wealth, land ownership even?
I think that's definitely true, Phil. And I also think that there's this sense that you know, the adults in their life are spending a lot of time having this nostalgia for home, a home that they can't go back to. And so these young native-born kids basically say, well, what's wrong with where we are? They also tend to have an affinity for the land. You know, they haven't seen the green pastures of England, so to speak. They've only heard about them. But they immediately feel some connection with their land. Many of them are learning bushcraft from the Aboriginal people that they're growing up with. So they're really connected to country. And when they hear all this stuff about wanting to go home to England, they think, stuff and nonsense, this is a great country. So much so that there's this kind of wonderful little story about a young native-born girl, and an Englishman comes up to her and says, you know, oh, wouldn't you like to go back to England? And she says, why would I want to go back there? That's where all the convicts came from. But, you know, when I bang on that heavy Australian accent to recount that, I'm actually being historically accurate because we know that as early as 1810, these people spoke with this flat nasal tone. They softened, they lengthened, they flattened their vowels so that all those kids playing in the streets, coming with parents from all different dialects all over England, over Great Britain, they could understand each other.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, we're starting to see these national characteristics. But while I was able to find quite a lot in the records about native-born men, you know, they were singing songs like The Land Boys We Live In, and they really believed that Australia was more beauteous and the women were more attractive than anything back in Europe. I couldn't find much about native-born women. They were very shadowy as a demographic, particularly those girls who grew up in the towns. So every now and again you got these wonderful, evocative, fleeting images of, say, a native-born girl who was riding bareback on a horse with nothing but linen pantaloons and ribbons flying through her hair, you know, these gorgeous kind of really Australian girl scenes. But I was so fascinated about what did native-born girls growing up in a town like Sydney in the 1840s think about the world that they were living in.
All right, well, let's talk about Mary Ann Gill. Her parents were emancipists, so they'd arrived in Australia as prisoners and done their time. But they were pretty enterprising, weren't they?
Right. So they both came from Dublin in the 1820s. Mm-hmm. And Marianne's mother had been a pastry chef in one of the best houses in Dublin on the St. Stephen's Green. And her father, Martin, was pretty much a street rat, living by his wits in Dublin before he was arrested and transported for stealing a hand griddle, a cooking implement. And they marry and very in Australia, in Sydney, and very quickly...
What had she done?
Well, she was a pastry chef.
But oh, see, she came out as a free sex.
Oh, she stole. No, sorry. No, they met in Sydney and married in Sydney. So she was transported for stealing a linen handkerchief of somebody in her house.
Okay, got it.
So there they were, and she actually came with her father, who was transported as well for the same crime. So I think they were, as you would call it, fencing.
Hmm.
That's right. So they arrive. And they meet Martin Gill, and Margaret marries Martin, and their first child is Marianne Gill, who's born in 1832 and baptised at St Mary's Cathedral, Roman Catholic. And the Gills are upwardly mobile, very ambitious and highly effective at what they do. They own confectionery stores, they own some of the best hotels, or they manage the best hotels, and they are on the up and up. And a group that is incredibly sympathetic with the colonial public in the 1840s, because they're seen to be hardworking and respectable, just the sort of people that you need to create a burgeoning middle class society that's going to be able to push forward political reform.
All right. So they're getting on. They've got a quid. Mm-hmm. Enter James Butler Kinchella, gentleman settler.
They don't just have a quid, Phil. They own the only three-story hotel in Sydney, and it's right on Pitt Street where Martin Place is today.
Okay.
So you can see it would be looking down over the harbour. It would be bringing in all those people coming in off the boats. And there they are at the top of their game with a great reputation, being known as respectable colonists, which was the most hard-earned title that you could get if you had once been a convict. James Butler Kinchella, the third son of a previous Attorney General known as John Kinchella, a man who unfortunately was known more for his deafness and his debt than anything he contributed to the colony. And his sons were, I guess you would say, Protestant ascendancy, but on the downward spiral. Their reputations were unravelling very quickly. And there's James Butler Kinchella. He comes into the hotel. He's staying a few nights. He's just got off the Moreton Bay steamer. And he sees Marianne Gill as she walks into the kitchen. Or rather, perhaps Marianne Gill saw him first. We don't know all the details.
But she's underage.
Well, underage according to whose values. For us today, yes, certainly. In fact,
she was
15. She was 1 month from turning 16.
Right.
And at the age of 16, she would have been able to exercise more authority over her right to marry. But at the age of 15, she was, according to marital law, her father's property. And she would actually remain that until her suitor had received permission from her guardians or parents to marry her.
So James Kinchella, though, was accused of abduction. So what did he do? Did he put her in his carriage and drive off?
Well, abduction is a fascinating crime, and it goes all the way back to the 14th century. It was really a way of dynastic families protecting their wealth from cads and bounders who might try and seduce with trifling tricks or flattery or violent kidnapping a young girl, an heiress, who owned the family wealth. And there are so many instances of families losing their money to these bounders and cads that they tried to stitch it up with this legislation that made the crime of abduction a capital of felony.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that in England until 1828 and in Ireland until 1842, you could actually be executed for eloping with a woman, regardless of whether or not this was elopement or not. It didn't matter whether or not she wanted it.
So did Kinchella actually elope, though, with her?
Well, I think so. You know, I've spent a lot of time, about 10 years with those records, and I've gone through the depositions, the newspaper files, and it seems pretty clear to me that this was highly consensual. In fact, we know it must have been because Marianne was quite ardent in her pursuit and her patience of her somewhat slippery suitor, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it was an elopement. He had persuaded her. to slip down out of her bedroom window, which was on the third floor of their Martin Street, well, their Pitt Street property, and for her to meet him at the Parramatta Racecourse, which was apparently some sort of Australian Gretna Green, and there they would get married. But James Butler Kinchela was a man who suffered from cold feet, mm-hmm. and he wasn't where he was meant to be at the right time. And this meant that the whole escapade was a disaster from beginning to end for poor old Mary Ann, who had already been told by her father that if she didn't mind herself and keep to herself, that she was going to find herself in a lot of trouble. And we know this from the deposition records, that he actually showed her his guns a couple of days before the elopement.
Oh, idea. All right. We're talking with Dr. Keira Lindsay from the University of South Australia about the story of Mary Ann Gill, who in 1848 in Sydney attempted to run away from home and marry a gentleman settler. The matter did end up in the courts, although in the end she did get her man, didn't she?
Well, you see, now you've told the end of the story. Mm-hmm. Well, she did, but there was certainly many a thwarted moment on that road to romance. So her father, when she disappeared, she went to the Parramatta Racecourse pub and she waited for Kinchela. Kinchela turned up and discovered that her father was coming, and so he disappeared and told her to come back again that night. So she came home, her father picked her up, dragged her back home, gave her a flogging, and within a few hours she had slipped out the window a second time and gone back out to the racecourse to meet him. And yet again, Kinchela was not there. So it's terrible, terrible. And this time she went and hid somewhere else. And by this time, Martin Gill had found out, and he, hardly waiting to strap his shoes on or change his nightshirt, got onto a horse, raced out to the Parramatta racecourse with two guns and fired them both at Kinchela.
Really?
Mm. In the morning dawn, people saw him thundering through the mist, you know, disappearing through the clouds and then appearing again. People thought he was mad or drunk as he arrived at the hotel where Kinchela was having his breakfast. And he presented the two guns and said, "Sir, will I give you time?" And then didn't give him any time. Shot at him twice, but missed on both occasions. And found himself being charged with shooting with intent, a crime for which, if he had been found guilty, he could have been executed.
Mm. Dear me.
So it's all very exciting. Yeah. But even though Martin Gill was very clearly guilty of this crime, he was found innocent by a sympathetic jury who liked that hard-working, respectable, working class, well, up-and-coming emancipator stock, and didn't like the free settler Attorney General's son thinking that he could take advantage and take what wasn't his. And to me, Phil, this is a story about what was going on in the political and social climate at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
People no longer liked gentlemen settlers who thought they could take whatever they want, whether it was land or ladies. They preferred people who worked hard and tried to protect their daughters. So the law went against Martin Gill and went in favour of Kinchela.
Hey. She had an interesting later life too, though, didn't she? She was went off to the Victoria, to the Californian goldfields. That must have been quite a journey to get there. How would you get there anyway?
Oh, you went by boat and you went through a kind of a tropical route. And so she would have travelled through some of the shipping routes that her father and mother and grandfather had come through when they were coming from Ireland. But, you know, I think it's a fascinating thing that we have this idea of a kind of tyranny of distance for Australian colonists, that they rarely left Australia. Mm. But in fact, they did. They travelled quite a lot. And Mary, not to say that Mary Ann wasn't quite surprising in that, as a young 17-year-old woman when she was travelling, she travelled with her brother and somehow she reconciled with her father and travelled with him. And they travelled specifically so that they could meet James Butler Kinchela over there and they could be married.
Okay. She, yes, and she, of course she, I mean, we're truncating a very long story here, I know. But she ends up back in Sydney, and amazingly, at the end of all these picaresque adventures, she ends up as the headmistress of of a girls' school.
Well, she does. And before she does that, she returns to Australia as a widow, a wealthy widow, because her husband, Concello, makes oodles of money on the goldfields. And she invests all her money in New Caledonia. But she loses it, so we're told, to shipwrecks and storms, tropical storms. So she loses all her money in the sugar plantations, returns to Australia, and starts up life again with her mother. Her father's disappeared from the scene, but her and her mother go off to Corowa. And there, Mrs. Beatty, as she's now known, reinvents herself as a respectable boarding house mistress, running quite a lovely home for young ladies, learning them, teaching them how to engage in tapestry and dancing and singing and cooking, which I'm sure they were taught by Marianne's mother, who had started life herself as a pastry chef in Dublin.
A life full of rich possibilities, which is what the colony, I guess, must have been like at the time too. Yes, fascinating stuff. Kira, excellent to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil.
Dr. Kira Lindsay from the University of South Australia.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.